All right, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Free for All. Thank you once again for joining us. As always, we tend to bring on guests who are able to address the pressing issues of the day, particularly from a libertarian perspective. And today we have with us a friend of the show, I'd like to think, and a newly minted vice presidential nominee of the Libertarian Party. Without further ado here on Grumblings Media, let me bring on Mike Termont. Mike, welcome to the show once again, sir.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it. I would like to think I'm a friend of the show. Thank you very much for having me on again.
Yes, absolutely, Mike. And you know, what's interesting is we could tell the folks, because we promoted it, I don't want people to think we were trying to gaslight them or do a bait and switch. It was supposed to be Chase and Mike.
That's on me. I apologize for that, but you're gonna have to make do.
That's okay. We love Chase, but we're happy to have you, Mike, because as always,
and you're with cause, you should love Chase.
Absolutely, yes. So, Mike, just to let everyone out there know, of course, they can send in questions for Mike to answer. He's more than willing to answer your questions. There's plenty of things that need to be addressed that, you know, there's a lot of chatter, some of it productive, some of it highly unproductive going around on social media today. But I want to give Mike the opportunity to talk about the platform, talk a little bit about the convention, and also address some of these issues. Because let's end the speculation, Mike. Let's hear it straight from the horse's mouth. Let's hear it from you, the vice presidential candidate, about some of these things going around. So I want to remind everyone, if you want to send in a question for Mike, please go on YouTube, Rumble, or Facebook Live. You can catch the show on X, but due to an API issue, we can't see your comments on X. So if you want to leave a question for Mike, please go to any one of those three. So, Mike, let's start off with the convention, because that's where all the drama started. So I would like to know that people who joined us last week, the free-for-all prior to the convention, a lot of the viewers, Mike, were asking me, Big John, who do you want to see come out as the presidential nominee? What's your preferred ticket? And to be 100% honest, what I said was, I would be happy with any one of or any two of these three forming a ticket: Chase Oliver, Mike Termont, Lars Mapstead. And I was being 100% honest. I think we had a slew of great candidates in the
LP
this year.
Well, you got two out of three. I'm sorry we couldn't get you all three. That's not how it works.
Well, Lars for Secretary of State or something like that, perhaps. And we can make me happy at that point, Lars.
I love Lars, and I would love for him to be Secretary of State. But I happen to know that Lars is a big fan of not filling all of the federal positions. So you'll have to talk him into it if I can't.
I would hope that we could at some point, but you're right. Lars is a great guy as well. So, Mike, let's start out with some initial thoughts. When we had talked about this in prior episodes, I asked you, what do you make of the whole RFK Trump being invited to the convention, right? You told me you were being very diplomatic, and you said, hey, we're going to make the best of this situation. But if I recall, you did a nice little civil act of disobedience, and I believe at the beginning of Trump's speech, you got up and you turned away and you walked out of the ballroom. Is that correct? Do I have my facts correct?
You do have your facts correct, but I should put it out that was Nancy's idea. My wife, Nancy, found the whole Trump experience a little bit cringy. And to be honest, so did I. And then we subsequently got in trouble for reasons that were out of my control. And I need to defend myself here, John. I've been falsely accused of having planned to go party. And that is false. I bumped into that party by mistake. That's not on me. Nancy and I, we did leave and we went downstairs to our exhibit booth and we were planning on retiring for the evening. And there was a party there that we had not been aware of. And we wound up dancing for a while, just the two of us, because the party was, of course, completely empty because everyone was off at the Trump rally. And someone shot a video and subsequently accused me of having planned a party instead of being with Trump. But I stand accused of actually partying instead of being with Trump, but not planned.
Okay.
But I want to make that clear.
Well, I'm glad you cleared that part up. But as to the point of both, I don't want to put the focus solely on Trump, but both RFK and Trump, now that it's over, if we give the benefit of every doubt to leadership, do you feel that their strategic gambit to invite two non-LP speakers, let's be honest, rival candidates to come out of rival parties, how do you feel that strategic gambit paid off, at least as we stand where we are today?
I would say it's a close call, but on balance, on net, I would say probably positive in the sense that we did get a little bit more publicity than I believe we were. I can't argue the negative, right? I don't know how much publicity right. we'd have gotten if they weren't there. So I'm, you know, this is a guess, right? But I think we got a little bit more publicity than we otherwise would have. And I believe the big concern I expressed was that there would be some super positive moment for the Donald or for RFK, and that would go viral and people would confuse them for libertarians or confuse us as Kennedyites or MAGA. And I don't think that happened. I'm not a huge follower of social media, so there could be stuff out there of which I'm not familiar. But I don't believe that happened. In fact, I saw some reporting of the Trump talk in which people said, whoa, tough crowd. They even showed him getting booed a little bit. So I got to say, you know, maybe some of my concerns were not misplaced, but the bad crap I had worried about didn't completely come to fruition. So In fairness to leadership, you know, on balance, maybe we whistled past the graveyard.
And watching the live stream with you, and I was not in Washington, I'll fess up to that, but I was on the live stream for almost the entire time. I don't think I slept, but of the two speeches, which one do you feel, if either one at all, resonated more with the libertarians at the convention, do you think? Was it the RFK speech or was it the Trump speech, do you think?
Well, it must have been the RFK speech because the Donald was almost uniformly and continuously in full length booed. So you can't get much lower than that. And in fairness, I blew off an even larger proportion of the RFK talk than I did the Donald talk. So you're probably asking the wrong guy, but people told me that at least RFK had a couple of positive moments. As you know,
right.
we find a little bit of common ground with RFK on medical freedom, for example.
Right.
There's a hell of a lot of places where we disagree with RFK, but you know, if we find common ground with RFK 35% of the time, you know, with the Donald, it's more like 15%. So I think that Bobby has an advantage there.
Yeah. You might be generous with the numbers, but I get your point.
I'm pulling those out of my ear.
Yeah, no, I got you, but I get your point on that. Mike, let's take a quick break. We have a question coming in from the comments. Robert Perry wants to know, I'd like to hear Mike address why libertarians should get behind a cop for VP.
Because a cop speaks more forcefully with more experience and a lot more credibility about the things that you care about, which is to say criminal justice reform, both ending the war on drugs and holding police accountable, and regarding local political issues, especially economic issues like zoning, housing, bad schools, the war on drugs, but also bad welfare policies and other bad local policies, because I've been there, I've been involved, and I've seen it, you know, firsthand, the effects of bad public policy on families that struggle with poverty, and in many cases, intergenerational, not just transient poverty.
Right.
So, you know, that is the reason you should not support someone who sees eye to eye on all of your issues unless you mean it. And the truth of the matter is that I have been there and people listen when I talk about police reform.
Yeah. And Robert, something I'd like to throw in, because I think it does affect the answer here is Mike was not a cop straight out of college. He wasn't a cop straight out of high school. He approached it after extensive life experience, Mike, wouldn't you say? Like, again, I keep getting the age wrong. Was it 42, 46? How old were you as keep a going. Rookie cop?
I turned 49 in the police academy.
Okay, so you were basically of a near 50-year-old rookie. It almost sounds like that TV show. I don't even know the name, right? But so you definitely had approached
it. What do you mean almost? The Rookie is a TV show about a guy who was like 41 and had trouble running.
You didn't have trouble running, did you, Mike?
I won the physical fitness award, John, and it wasn't age adjusted.
Oh, fantastic. So there you go. Not a cop on some sort of DEI assignment, Mike. You earned that spot and let's clear this up. Are libertarians supposed to be against every cop, Mike? Because I've heard that used as a pejorative against you by some members, by some factions within the Libertarian Party, right?
No, it's silly. There are some people who don't like police officers, and there's some people that don't like vanilla ice cream. I don't care about all that. If you're in favor of reform, holding police accountable, ending the war on drugs, ending qualified immunity, getting rid of the silly notion of asset forfeiture, if you're in favor of making sure that your law enforcement agency is forced to align with local values, then we're on the same page. I don't care how you feel about your opinions about police officers.
And that's a fair response, I think, Mike. Okay. Getting back to the convention a little bit. As we all saw, high drama at the convention. And for those that don't understand
that
the
might
libertarian,
be an oversell, John, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, you know, it's media, Mike. We got to oversell a little bit.
You know, all right, I'll play it up with you.
Okay. So for those that are not aware, the libertarian nominees are not selected by the primary system or through a caucus system state by state. The delegates all arrived at our national convention in Washington, D.C., and it's the delegates that then on the floor, old school, pick their candidates. And there's rules to who gets eliminated round by round. It took Chase seven. He won in the seventh round. In the sixth round, the last two were Dr. Rechtenwald and Chase. Mike, you lasted until the fifth round, I believe, and you left with roughly, when you were eliminated, you had accumulated, I'd say about 25, 26% of the delegate count. What I thought made for drama, because you don't see this in the two statist parties, in the duopoly at all, is the moment where you walked up, you were eliminated from the race, you walked up to the mic, you kind of thanked your delegates and the party in the process, and at that moment, you announced that you had been offered and accepted to run as Chase's VP. The hall erupted, I thought, in maybe 60-40, 70-30 cheers to agonizing groans. So for those that are not aware of inside
in fairness,
libertarian,
agonizing groans are harder to hear, so the audible measurement is difficult.
That's a good point, sir. I'll grant you that. But for those like myself who are not inside libertarian politics, explain a little bit to me, if you can, the negotiations, the back and forth, the deals. Now, to set the stage, I actually don't know the answer to this, so it's not a softball question. Were you or are you a member of the Mises Caucus, or did you have no caucus affiliation heading into the convention?
Yes, I have been a member of the Mises Caucus for years. Parenthetically, and probably less importantly, I'm also a member of the other caucuses, but for a longer period of time in a much more robust fashion, I've been a member of the Mises Caucus. I've supported the caucus with money, some time and energy, and they have been very supportive of me in my past run for Congress, that sort of thing. They did endorse a candidate against me.
Okay. So at that point, when you announced you had accepted Chase's offer to be his running mate, I believe it was, and actually Linda, let me see this. Linda's actually putting this, and it kind of dovetails into my next question. I believe it was Heiss. Is that how you pronounce his last name? Heiss? Michael Heiss?
Yeah, Michael.
Michael. Kind of jumped up to your mic and said, we offered Mike the VP the spot with Dr. Rechtenwald, with Mike Rechtenwald. We offered it. So there was a little bit of confusion in my mind, being a viewer. I can imagine libertarian outsiders saying, hey, what's going on with these libertarians? What's, you know, one guy, they're fighting over Termott here. He just bowed out in the fifth round. And Linda
says,
it wasn't
so much they were fighting over me, John. They were fighting over my delegates.
Yes.
Would that I were so terrific that they would, you know, all consider me to be the big prize to be won. That's not really, just to be fair, they coveted the delegates that they thought that I might be able to influence.
Right, because their endorsed VP candidate was Clint Russell, correct?
That's correct.
Right.
Who, by the way, is a good guy. Chase had also indicated that he had a preferred candidate who is a good candidate, you know, a very strong person as well.
Okay. So Linda says there's a photo on the internet of you talking to Heiss reminding you of the promise you would endorse Rechtenwald. Is this true or not?
Not really, from a couple of standpoints. Number one, the photo is actually of him explaining why he turned down my offer of stepping out of it and letting the two sides of the debate, the two sides of the party work together without me. My initial idea was that I wouldn't run for VP at all and that they would find some way to work together for a variety of reasons that was difficult for the Mises Caucus to work through. Michael was explaining that he had other commitments. I don't blame him for that.
Right.
And I understand why politically and perhaps even policy-wise, I won't presume to speak for him. But that would have been a difficult thing. Michael believed we had had discussions in which I had indicated both to him and to Rechtenwald that it would be my expectation to support the Mises Caucus candidate because we had so much in common policy-wise and so much history. They knew, and I made this abundantly and explicitly clear, that I couldn't cut a deal in advance and that I didn't anticipate cutting a deal on the floor, all of which is true. And it is true that I had indicated to them that it was certainly my expectation that I would be able to support them. We felt very strongly that what was necessary was a unified ticket, something that would bring both sides of the party together. And that was the reason behind the decision that that I made.
So as part of your announcement, was that what you referred to as a difference in strategic approach? I believe that was the phrase you used, right? That you couldn't see eye to eye on the strategy of the Mises Caucus in that moment. So is that what you were referring to when you said that at the mic? What you just explained
to
us?
We had a long history, Michael Heiss and I, of disagreeing about strategy and I consider that to be important as well as trying to unify the party. That's right.
Okay. So just to be 100% clear then, there was never a promise made to support Rechtenwald by you in terms of...
No, there was not a promise. I had certainly indicated that was my expectation. Absolutely. Michael Rechtenwald and I saw eye to eye on virtually every policy. We have differences on, for example, immigration policy and a couple other things, but we saw eye to eye on so much that it was absolutely my expectation that I would be able to support him. When it came right down to it, I felt that unifying the party and doing so with a guy with whom I actually, as it turns out, don't have nearly as many policy differences as I thought. That we had. And I thought that unifying the party was very, very important. I also believe, and I still believe, that our strategic differences between me and the Mises Caucus are very significant.
Do you feel that you're deciding, and this is a tough question, Mike, so if you want to pass, I'll understand, but I'll have to ask it, which is as the result of you joining Chase's Ticket, do you feel you achieved or are in the process of achieving that overall unity that you talked about, party unity?
Absolutely. That was the hard question. That was the easiest question you've asked so far.
Okay, fair enough. Because there's a lot of chatter, and now again, it's tough for outsiders
only
to understand.
Inside the party.
Inside the party, yes, that's right. What I meant. Inside the party.
Okay, but in the grand scheme of things, that's very small.
Gotcha. Right. Yes.
Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that, but they're also the most vociferous, Mike. They're the loudest. And sometimes, as we know, even with the status parties, sometimes the fringes are the least in number, but they make the most noise. They get the most media attention, right? So,
Not in this case. I seriously doubt that a significant media attention is going to be paid to this. Well, first of all, I would argue that there has not been to date serious media attention, but I don't believe that there will be any media attention paid to this in a matter of days.
Right.
Let's put it this way. I haven't seen any. I know it's out there because I'm told.
Right.
Well, I just don't think for the average American voter.
Yeah.
Look, the average American voter has never heard of the Libertarian Party.
Mm.
To be fair, right? We should be so lucky that there's a lot of media attention on internal politics of the Libertarian Party.
But I think it's going to change. Personally, I think it's going to change every year.
I do, too. And I'm an optimist. And a piece of that is going to be more positive than it otherwise would be because we represent the full spectrum of outlook within the Libertarian Party.
Agreed. 100%. I agree with you. And if I seem a little distracted, it's because the comments are coming in fast and furious. So I want to try to organize them according to the show. So let me ask you this, sort of putting a bow on the convention issues. The Vivek and Clint debate, okay, the VP debate. I saw some of it.
I was there for some of it.
Yeah. To be honest with you, I viewed it more as a mutual admiration society between the three of them, and I'm throwing Dave Smith into that. But let me ask you this. One of the things that troubles me as someone watching this is when I hear an agreement that what we need is libertarian nationalism. Now, in my mind, those are two antonyms. Thank you, sir. I wanted you to give me your thoughts about that because I view libertarianism as fealty to the individual. I view nationalism as fealty to the nation.
It's fealty to the individual and his relationship to his maker.
Okay, so you
is the opposite of nationalism.
I agree with you. So I guess you're answering my question, which is you think there is no such thing as
libertarian. Go ahead with the question.
No. So do you think there is libertarian nationalism?
No, there's no such thing. It's like saying blue, red.
Right, or vegetarian carnivore, right? So let me ask you this. What do you think is meant? Because Vivek is not a stupid man by any stretch of the imagination. I don't think Clint
is. I'll defer to your judgment on that, John.
Fair enough. What I meant is his judgment may be off. I don't think doesn't have things going on up here.
I can speak more firsthand about Clint Russell. He is a very smart guy.
Fair enough. So what do you think is meant?
Did he say anything about nationalism?
I don't want to misquote him or attribute something to him that he didn't say.
I haven't heard Clint talk about that. Maybe he has, but.
But I have heard some of the, or seen some of the, that wing of the party refer to it. Not everybody. I don't want to make it seem like it's rampant. But in your mind, libertarian nationalism shouldn't be a thing, right?
No, it's not a thing. There's no such thing as libertarian nationalism. And I have not heard it from more than, you know, really two different people inside of our party. So I don't think it's a big concern.
Okay, fair enough. So I just wanted to make sure we're clear on that. Okay, let's move on to some issues now. And before we do, let's address some breaking news. Former President Trump found guilty on 34 criminal counts in New York. Give me your thoughts on that real quick.
Number one, I'm shocked. Number two, I'm disappointed at the prospect that he won't be able to vote for Chase and me.
Well, he said he's libertarian, right?
He did, but in this context, to your point, very good, John. In this context, he said something like, I'm paraphrasing, you may know exactly. He said something like, if I wasn't before, I sure as hell am now, you know, something like this, right? Because he's been indicted so many times. Look,
right.
Just because you've been indicted doesn't make you a libertarian. I've met a hell of a lot of criminals in my day, and I could not characterize them as all libertarian. Republicans and Democrats can be criminals too. I don't think one of the reasons I'm shocked by the outcome here. Well, it's very difficult to predict these things, so I probably shouldn't be shocked. You know, what do I know about what 12 people are thinking when they get locked in a room for a couple of days? And I know a lot comes down to the jury instructions, which I thought were difficult, I guess, is the word that I would use. I also think that the case was difficult to focus on. I think there was a tremendous amount of distraction successfully put up by the prosecution. I don't think that there was a great deal of focus on what the elements of the crime actually were. I didn't like the judge's implication that you could determine that Trump was guilty of a misdemeanor, even if you didn't all 12 agree on which misdemeanor it was. I found that extremely problematic. I'm told, I'm not an attorney, and even if I were an attorney, I doubt I would spend a great deal of time researching Supreme Court cases. But I'm told there's a Supreme Court decision out there that supports this idea that you can disagree on which misdemeanor, but as long as you all agree that there was one, you're good to go in terms of what it is that, you know, the bookkeeping entry was trying to hide.
Right.
I find that deeply problematic, even if there is a Supreme Court case out there backing it up. It's my view. And look, don't mishear me. I'm no fan of the Donald. I mean,
right.
I was in New York in the 80s. I've got all kinds of historical reasons to dislike this guy. I think he is not an ethical guy. I don't think he's a principled guy. I don't like his politics. He's not the kind of guy that strikes me as someone I'd like to have dinner with. Right.
Right. Right.
But having said all, none of that makes him a criminal. Right.
Right. And right.
It seems to me that this is a prosecution that was deeply politically motivated, either politically, you know, broadly defined or narrowly defined, you know. I'm not a big fan of looking into people's hearts and try to figure out what their motivation is, right? Which is part of the reason why I got a problem with the prosecution, because that's in effect what it is that they're asking the jury to do regarding Trump. Right. You know, this whole thing is, you know, was it really meant to help him out in the election, and therefore had to be reported to the FEC, and by not doing so, he had to cover it up, yada, 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 yada. I've got a problem with that whole thing. But I've also got a problem with people who try to figure out why the prosecutor did this. I think that this was a bad prosecution, but I'm not sure exactly why. You know, I don't know whether, you know, he doesn't strike me as an incompetent prosecutor. He strikes me as an oddly motivated one, but I can't put my finger on whether it's, you know, political per se. Like he hates Donald for being a Republican, or he hates him for being a jerk, or whatever that is. Or alternatively, you know, he's trying to make a name for himself, or it's not up to me to try to figure out what the motivation is. But the number of things that you have to legally disregard to bring this process, you know, everything from the fact that the FEC never prosecuted the misdemeanor, never even came after Trump for a request for further information. I got it. By the way, this is something. Thank you for letting me prattle on here just for a moment.
That's okay. Go ahead, sir.
My campaign manager says I prattle on too much. So hopefully he's not watching this. But by the way, I've done a lot of FEC filings, right? I typically do them myself. And every once in a while, I screw something up. That comes as a great shock to absolutely no one, right? And my analyst at the FEC, super, super kind. And I always tease her that, you know, it's my job to rail against the deep state and talk about how the FEC shouldn't exist and how horrible all you people are. And she continues to be super kind with me. she will send me one of those, you know, notes that says request for further information, which basically says, you know, you screwed up line 15, right, box 23A, blah, 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 blah. The FEC didn't even go after Trump with, you know, with that.
Right, right.
And so, you know, this idea that he committed a crime and the FEC missed it.
Right. Seems. Yeah. Yeah, I got you.
That's stretching credulity. And then to come after him out of jurisdiction, out of the time requirement, by the way, right? The statute of limitations had expired. Out of a conviction. There's no conviction, right? There's no jurisdiction. You're not within the statute of limitations. There's no jury requirement that they even all agree that he committed this crime. Well, I think that we should find that deeply troubling. I think that we should find that deeply troubling. And again, not because Donald Trump is a good guy. We just don't jail people for being jerks.
Right. Right. I think that's the thing to take away from that.
And one of the things that really bothers me, if I can just...
Sure, finish that up.
Wrap up my prattling. As long as I'm getting in trouble for prattling too much, I might as well take a full bite of the apple. For Trump to be out here saying, you know, he's a libertarian because he's been prosecuted and he feels it's unfair. You know, this is a guy who passed up opportunities in the past to do right by people who really are jailed for implausible reasons and implausible sentences. He could have done right by some folks, not only for them individually and personally, which one might argue matters, but more importantly, as a matter of principle.
Right.
And he didn't.
Right. So look, some of this might be karma, even if we can agree that this is a politically motivated trial. FYI, Colorcraft, how can we send a donation? Someone is impressed enough, Mike, to ask, how can they send a donation?
Well, now, in fairness, they didn't say they would. They just wanted to know how. You know, maybe they're trying to develop a website, and they just want to know how it's done. But you can go to MikeTremont.com and click on, you know, donate. You can go to Vote Oliver, VoteChaseOliver.com. I'm still getting used to the website. And you can donate there as well.
Right. I think I have them here. Let me pop that up for you.
VoteChaseOliver.com. Thank you very much.
VoteChaseOliver.com.
I embarrass myself.
And you could also always go to the Libertarian Party homepage where they have Mike, Chase and Mike's campaign info there as well. So there you go. Some other, just to clear out some of these comments, one that I find interesting. Here you go. Scotty Bowman. Will the Oliver Termott campaigns adopt the Stop 270 strategy that Lars Mapstead and Larry Sharp have advocated for? And we had Larry and Lars together the night before they announced this initiative. I'd like to take credit for pairing them up, Mike, somehow. I want to spin it to my benefit. But the truth of the matter is we had them on the night before. Then they announced this, which I think has some strategic merit to it. Give me your thoughts on it.
No.
No, just out of hand, no. Now, is that you won't be adopting it, which I'm assuming is the no, but do you feel this is a valid strategic approach?
No.
No. Go ahead, explain that.
I'm trying to make up for my earlier prattling. look, I think there are three different problems with it. One is it's unlikely to be really effective in a strategic sense, because even if you were successful in winning a couple of electoral votes, the idea that it would be, you know, earth shattering to the process are, you know, the chance, it's just vanishingly small probability. You know, you'd have to believe that Trump and Biden were either in a complete exact dead tie or off by one, you know.
Right.
And even then, you know that the tiebreaker goes to the Republicans. Because of, you know, how it's decided
in the House,
states in the House, right, blah, blah, blah. Number two, I don't like it because I don't believe that strategically you can serve two masters, in effect. You've got to pick a national campaign, or you've got to pick a campaign that says, in effect, yeah, we're national, but we're going to bias toward these couple of areas. Number three, by announcing or letting it be known, and, you know, there's no real secrets in politics. We like to pretend there are, but there aren't.
Right.
By making it known that you're focusing on these areas, you effectively have raised your hand to announce that you're not competing nationally. This is the biggest problem. Once you say, I can't win, you have removed yourself from the race. The only reason anybody pays any attention to candidates is because they think that they can win. There's, you know, there's two categories of candidates, those that can win and those who can't, right? And we desperately need to get into, you know, the former category. We need people to believe that we can actually win. That's the only way to reach that tipping point and really take off. And if you indicate that you can't, look, this, you know, you've heard me say this many times before. This is not a philosophy seminar. This is a competition.
Right. So, okay.
You know, that's critical. And if there's one more reason, it is that it's a strategy that suggests that we're going to become relevant the night after the election. I would like to think that we're going to be relevant nationally for the next 150 days.
Love it. Love it, Mike. Let's move on to some campaign issues because I want to touch on these. Now, when I address these issues, to be fair, initially, I thought it would be both you and Chase addressing them. So some of these might be more tailored.
I apologize again.
No, that's okay. But what I meant by that
know,
is...
I'm not as, you know, charming, and I'm not as smart, and I'm, you know, not as good looking, but I am available.
You've got that sexy cop vibe. So I think that
that's red, blue. That's like libertarian nationalist.
There you go. Right. There you go. Okay, Mike. So the first one that both on Twitter and in our comment section right now that I guess Chase would have been better equipped to, but this seems to be one of the, I would say, top two or three things that are coming up, especially against the libertarian ticket, quote, being too woke. And what I want to, the first one is obviously the support for transitioning minors, for giving puberty blockers to minors. If I say something incorrect, please jump in. Chase's position.
We already have. We don't support it. We just don't think that the, you know, our team's position is that the government doesn't necessarily have a role in certain circumstances. Chase and I both strongly believe that with regard to these life-changing, body-changing surgeries, there ought to be an age of consent reached. We agree wholeheartedly on that, by the way.
And I think there seems to be sort of a division that people understand, okay, the surgeries they understand for minors because they are permanent, right? But I think this is referring more to the hormone treatments, puberty blockers, things of that nature. Chase has said that that is a decision that the state should stay out of, much like with whether you get vaccinated or not.
And anything else.
And anything else. Absolutely. So, however, for example, if we're to say it's up to the parents to decide whether or not, say, puberty blockers are the proper form of treatment in their child's specific case without making a blanket policy statement. And I believe that's what I've heard Chase say. Again, I'll let you see if I'm right or wrong here. And actually, there's a question in here. I'm trying to find it. Yes. So to that extent, it says, since Chase agrees that it's a parent's right whether to use puberty blockers, I guess for their minor kid in this case, logic dictates that he'd agree it's a parent's right to send their child to gay conversion therapy. I'm assuming by that they mean the conversion therapy to being straight, I guess. I don't know. Correct or no?
Well, first of all, I don't think the logic is there. Someone would have to take some time to convince me that those two dots connect. So just let's leave that aside just for a moment. I don't think that this is a public policy issue burning up the campaign trail either. By the way, I don't think any of these issues are burning up the campaign trail, just parenthetically.
Okay.
I don't mind answering them. Don't get me wrong. But yeah. I think that the reason these questions are coming up is per se to be divisive. Just let me just say that. I think that's the motivation behind them. I don't think that these issues affect nearly as many people as monetary policy, fiscal policy, ending the war on drugs, ending the militaristic style of foreign policy that we have, or holding police accountable. Just by the way, okay?
FYI.
As long as we're going down an irrelevant rabbit hole, I will go with you.
Sure.
Of all the things I'm not expert on, this is probably the top of the list. So let's be maybe you are, so you can guide me through it. But
I'm not, but go ahead.
Okay. Some of these things are relatively permanent. Some of these things are not. And different drugs have different effects. So I appreciate the fact that these are all gray areas. I don't think as a society we are yet in a place where we want to criminalize, you know, certain medications because we're not sure, you know, how they work. I just don't think that that's the appropriate role of government in some of these gray areas. And our team's position is that until and unless we have a hell of a lot more information, we're just not prepared to invite the government into this area.
Gotcha.
You know, in that sense, this is quite different from where I think we all agree, for example, which is surgery that's obviously permanent, that's, you know, not medically indicated, requires a certain age of consent, no matter how the parents and doctors feel about it. But, you know, remember that criminalizing something is a sledgehammer. Take it from a police officer. Law enforcement of the criminal code is a fairly blunt instrument.
Right.
I'm not sure that you want to invite that in. You know, I don't agree with some of this stuff. Maybe you don't agree with some of this stuff. I don't think that shouldn't be, you know, you shouldn't be asking John and Mike their opinion on this and then all of a sudden decide you're going to change the criminal code over it.
Right, right. So as it ties in the sense that the connecting tissue there might be healthcare in general, right? You're anti-mandate from the start. I know Chase has been anti-mandate from the start, despite some of the libeling I've seen out there.
People like to lie.
Yeah. So the position
Chase
here
has always been anti-mandate.
So to that extent, should small businesses have the right to discriminate based on vaccine status?
Businesses do have the right to discriminate on anything. The question is, should the government have the authority to take away their rights?
And what's that answer?
Well, just to make sure we understand the question, because how you ask the question ultimately, you know, colors where you end up. I am not a big fan of the government taking away business owners and business operators' rights regarding anything.
Right.
I think that if you own and run a business, you ought to have the right to be as completely moronic as you want.
So
I've met a lot of stupid business owners. I wouldn't jail them over it.
Right. So the issue is that, correct me if my thinking as a libertarian here is aligned with yours, that absent government coercion, absent government regulation, the free market would either reward or punish business behavior in the marketplace. A small business that discriminated against homosexuals would be challenged by the bar across the street that would cater to homosexuals, right? And we'd see which one won out in the marketplace. A business that said, I will not serve the vaccinated, if they could somehow tell, that would suffer as opposed to those that say
it's an interesting question because I don't know how you would determine that. But
right.
Look, and it's not about this is not a question about vaccination. This is a question about a business owner's right to be stupid. Let's call it what it is.
That's, sure.
Because you know you replace vaccination with any other word, right?
Right.
Should an employer have the right to fire you for wearing ugly shoes? Should they have the right to fire you for, you know, having a last name of Termot? That, of course, would be horrible. But but everything else, I think, is fair game.
You mean that?
I don't think you want to invite the government in to decide what it is you can fire someone for.
Right. Yes, I agree. Okay. Again, sorry for these questions. Colorcraft, the federal budget is $6 trillion with an exclamation point. What would an Oliver Termot ticket target for cutting?
$6 trillion.
All of it.
Afuera. I think all of it has to be targeted.
Right.
Again, how you ask the question determines what your answer is going to be. Let's be honest. It's very difficult for congresspersons to vote against a particular program. Just keeping it real.
Right.
Whereas it's easier for Congress to enact what Congress had in place to a certain extent when I worked for the White House several thousand years ago, which is to say budget control law. So if they spent too much money, there was an overall cap and everything got haircut down.
Right.
That is politically much more feasible. What we need to do is cap total spending and ratchet it down over time dramatically.
Right.
And not just in an inflation adjusted sense, but in a nominal sense. You know, you got to take it from 6 trillion to 5 to 4 to 3 to 2 to 1 irrespective of what inflation is doing. We need to target 0% inflation, but that's a completely separate subject.
You might as well put us on the gold standard again, Mike.
I don't, that'd be fine. I don't think you have to go all the way back to a gold standard. All you have to do is get us out of this silly idea of having a Federal Reserve System with complete discretion over how much money they issue.
Right.
If you just got rid of the Fed and told the government that it wasn't allowed to create any more money than would be required to target 0% inflation, you would have a much more robust and financially safe environment in which to do business.
Now, Mike, you're an Austrian economist. I know you actually worked at the Federal Reserve. Is that correct at one point in your career?
I worked for the White House. I didn't work for the Fed. I spent a lot of time working with the Fed in the sense that, you know, I was yelling at them for a good 8 years.
Yeah, so
they wouldn't call it me working with them. They would call it Mike being a pain in the ass again. But
Fair enough. Is it true? Like, I've read this stat. I don't know if it's true that supposedly if you just kept the federal budget static, no increase, not even really decreasing, it just kept it static, that the economy is robust enough that within, I believe, roughly 8 to 10 years, you would have a balanced budget. Do you think that makes sense at all as a first step?
That would require a significant amount of inflation. When those numbers are put together, what they're saying is you hold spending still in a nominal sense and you inflate your way out of it. And so I've got my fundamental problem is, well, that's not cutting spending fast enough or grossly enough, but it's also dependent on there being some inflation that we're trying to zero out.
Mm.
And sorry, that was my brother barking there.
There you go.
He's very upset. If you say inflation, the dog goes crazy.
I don't blame him. And I don't blame an Austrian for maybe not agreeing with the Chicago school sort of solution. So I kind of get that too. So, all right, along the same lines, Robert Perry says, the one place I really got through to a young Trump fan at the rally to take pause is Social Security. What would Oliver Termot say to my young MAGA friend who doesn't want to pay for my retirement? That's a great question. What would you say to this person? What would you say to Robert Perry to tell his MAGA friend, Mike?
Social Security is evil.
The idea of coercing, forcing
young people into a system that guarantees them a crappy rate of return, or possibly no return at all, but at best a crappy rate of return, giving them no option, right?
Yep.
Only because you designed the system badly in the first place, and now you've got this huge overhang of old people you got to take care of.
Right.
Don't get me wrong. Old people drawing Social Security, they're not evil, okay?
Right.
I want to make that perfectly clear. I'm not calling my mother evil. but if you, you know, if you're forcing people into the system just because it's badly designed, that's an ethical problem. That's not just arithmetic. That's not just a mathematics problem. That's not just bookkeeping, accounting. It's not just economics. That's an ethical, values-laden judgment. And I've got a problem with that.
Right.
So in my view, you need to shut it down right away, letting people come into this, forcing people into the system has got to stop, right? Just hard right. Day one. People who are already in the system receiving benefits, you know, at the tail end, you can offer them a lump sum or, you know, whatever. I suppose they can continue to draw. That's not really an interesting question. The people in the middle who have paid in some, I think you got to pay them out. I suppose you could offer them a transition or a mix. It doesn't really matter. But the point is, you got to shut down the system right away in terms of bringing new blood in.
New suckers into the pyramid, right? By the way, FYI, everyone, I'll plug this a little bit. I actually had the opportunity to interview both Chase and Mike on my Big Questions with Big John show, long form interview, about an hour and a half each. Mike is smiling. He was bored by the end of it. But
that
their
is
positions.
Completely untrue. That's a lie. That's a bald faced lie.
But folks, go over to Big Questions with Big John. You could catch their full length interviews, and they'll give you more insight into these two great guys running on the LP ticket. And for those of you in the comments, I see all your questions. Yes, Chase was scheduled to come on. He had to cancel at the last second with his apologies. Mike is here. He's honoring his commitment to talk to us. So
I apologize for that. It was, there's absolutely nothing that Chase could have done about it. Don't blame him. It was,
things happen on the campaign trail. That's, you know, people have to accept that reality.
To switch some things off. It was the truth is that it was nine parts my fault and one part staff fault. It was absolutely my own fault.
That's okay. But I just want to let people know, because people are like, I got questions for Chase specifically, and I'm ignoring you, yes, but not for any particular reason. Okay.
Well, maybe it's something, I mean, if it's something I can answer.
Sure. So the next one I'm going to ask is the accusations that Chase, in particular, is pro open borders. Now, before you answer the question, I have two things to say about this. Right. So first of all, that was the first thing I was going to say. It's not true. And the second thing is, all of those people who say they are pure libertarians who are anti open borders, I hate to break it to you, it's really the correct libertarian. You may not agree with it, but it's the correct libertarian position. Free people, free movement, free markets. That's all. Anything with the word free in front of it is typically libertarian. But having said that, Mike, clarify, if you will, what
Chase has always said that he wants the style of immigration that is as close as possible to Ellis Island, that we need to get people in as absolutely quickly as possible. Chase recognizes, as do I. You've heard me say it 100 times.
Absolutely.
Immigration is good for America. And I happen to know that Chase believes that. And we have talked about this many times. It is true that Americans expect some vetting at the border. But there is no reason that has to be so prolonged and protracted and tedious. It's just stupid. If there's not a felony warrant out there for you, you know, if there's not some reason to believe that, you know, you're trying to do harm to America or Americans, get in here and get to work. The thing about our immigration policy that I think not enough people focus on is this dopey idea that we would be inviting people in and then telling them they can't work. That's completely backwards. Why would you recruit people? I mean, what do you, are you actually trying, you're looking for people who are lazy? Like that's what we're here for? It's completely bass-ackwards. The reason people want to come to America is to work, build a life for their families, and we should get them to do that straight away.
Oh, absolutely. You and I have talked about this specifically. We had an episode dedicated to immigration, and I think both of us agree throughout American history, there's always been an immigrant group that you want to blame for something, whether it's the Germans, the Irish, the Italians. Like seriously, every part, you know, with the America First parties and all that, immigration is a net positive for this country. And
the only group that ever avoided all of that torturous bias were the Dutch, because everyone knows the Dutch should come here. The Dutch built this country. The Dutch have been a tremendous asset to America, and we need more of them.
Yeah, we just got to keep them from sticking their fingers in random holes and walls, though. But that's about it, Mike. and I had a chuckle at this comment. Robert Perry says, well, not free things that require the labor of others. But yeah, libertarians believe in free as an adjective. So we'll give that joke.
Said. Well said. Well, that alludes to an important point. We want to bring immigrants in and faster, but that doesn't mean we want to pass out free money as they come in.
Right. Well, you've got to, and that's more of the welfare state. It's an issue of the welfare state more so or entirely so as opposed to the issue of immigration.
That's well said.
Ken Corrado says, do you support the elimination of the Department of Education on the federal level? And if so, what role should the federal level play to support the states?
0.0. The answer to the first part is yes, but it doesn't go far enough. There is no reason to have a Department of Education at the state level either. This idea that school boards can't take care of their own business, I think is completely. So I'm not a big fan of public education at all, but anyone who's ever been to a school board meeting knows darn well that they can take care of business. Now they may make some horrible decisions, but you know, state departments of education are no silver bullet against local school boards making bad decisions. I think that we need greater competition among schools. And in the long run, I think that that will eventually sunset this silly notion that there should be government schools.
Absolutely. I agree with you. If anything, since the introduction of the Department of Education, educational quality has gone down in this country, I think, by every metric.
I'll leave it to your viewers to decide whether or not that's a coincidence.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, here's a tough question, Mike. I told you I wouldn't shy away from this, so I'm warning you. Linda says, several internet users have accused you of police brutality, I'm assuming from when you were a cop, specifically in Hallandale. Is that a place, Mike? Hallandale.
I work for the city.
You work for the city of Hallandale. Great. Where you entered a home/apartment without a warrant. Did you commit a warrantless entry? That there's these accusations floating out there.
The question, I'm not certain about the case to which they're alluding, but if it's the one I'm thinking of, I've never been accused of anything even rhyming with police brutality. That's just a silly implication. And please, that's a when did you stop beating your wife type of question. No one's ever even accused me of that. And nobody would, and no one I've ever worked with would even suggest that that's conceivable. There was a case in which our police department was dispatched to the wrong place. We had a guy in handcuffs for something like 6 minutes before realizing it was the wrong guy. And he is seeking compensation for that. And, to be honest, I think that that makes some sense. You want police officers and agencies to be held accountable. Just because nobody made a mistake on purpose doesn't mean that, someone who feels that they have been wrong shouldn't have the right to redress. That's just fundamental. And to say otherwise is un-American in my view.
Okay. So I think you've addressed that head on. So basically you got the wrong address. You ended up at an apartment, acted on some information. Now that person mentioned warrantless. Now, is that the case where even with the wrong address, did you have a warrant for the wrong address, if that makes sense?
There was I'm actually not allowed to talk in too much detail. My understanding, and this is, I was not involved in the documentation, but my understanding is that there was probable cause, but no, there was not a forced entry. There was not an uninvited entry, you know, nothing like that.
Gotcha, Mike. Okay. Oh, and Robert says, Mike's wife is lovely. Good job, Mike. I guess he figures you outkicked your coverage, Mike. Infer from that comment.
No, that's absolutely true. And I appreciate the good job. But the truth of the matter is I had nothing to do with making Nancy so lovely. If she had married some other guy, she'd be just as gorgeous and sweet and perfect.
Yeah, Mike, I thought when I saw your wife at the convention, I have never met her before. I'd never seen her. And I said, man, I hope Mike's wife doesn't see him stepping out with that lovely young thing on his arm over there. So I'm glad to find out it was, in fact, your wife.
Please, people, she's only 8 years younger than I am. Can we not exaggerate this? She just looks 28 years younger than I am. I resent the idea that I was robbing the cradle.
That was a great answer, by the way, Mike. That should get you out of Dutch, pardon the pun, for the next argument.
Well, I hope so. It is the reason I carry.
There you go. All right. Let's finish up on some of these issues. What is the Chase Oliver, Mike Termout position on the whole Hamas Israel situation? Tragedies on both sides there. Tell me what's going on as part of your positions on that.
Tragedies on both sides. You're exactly right, John. The whole situation is absolutely horrific. There's no question that Hamas and the Israeli government have both engaged in activities that, let's just say, to give us pause or are deeply concerning, would be an understatement. Having said that, I truly believe that the Israeli government needs to be able to pursue foreign policy independent of Washington, and that Washington needs to be divorcing itself from an idea that would suggest that we need to be held accountable for decisions made by other governments. I think we got to get out of the business of foreign aid. Foreign aid, whether it looks like cash or whether it looks like weapons or whether it looks like CIA help or NSA help or intelligence. We need to get out of that business completely. And by the way, here's my prediction. See if you like it. You ready?
Yeah,
by the way, almost all of my predictions are wrong. Just bear that in mind for a moment, okay?
Well, you're a Cubs fan, right?
What's that?
You're a Cubs fan, right? So they must be wrong most of the time.
They've been wrong 99 times out of the last 100. That's exactly right. Once I got it right in 2000.
I couldn't resist, Mike. I couldn't resist. You're a Cubs fan. Okay, go ahead.
I appreciate you rubbing it in and remembering that I'm a Cubs fan. Here's my big prediction for 2024. Drum roll. I predict that the Israeli government, before the end of this calendar year, will decide itself that the relationship with the American federal government isn't worth it to them.
Mm. So they're just going to say, we're out of the USA business.
That's what I believe. I believe they're going to say, you know what, a couple of billion dollars a year is not worth the headache of trying to get Washington to agree with every stupid thing that we do. And the Israeli government does do stupid things. Let's just call it like it is.
Yeah.
I don't believe that Washington should be held accountable for the Israeli government and vice versa. These are a couple of organizations that they vie for, you know, which one makes the other one look stupid.
And just to wrap that up, do you view Hamas as a terrorist organization or do you view them as? Yes. Okay.
Is there another category? I'm just looking here. My computer says it's unplugged.
Oh, okay. Well, we won't keep it too long.
One of my staffers here, if they can help me plug in the computer.
Fair enough.
The computer, it wants to die.
Oh, no, don't let it die just yet, Jay. So we'll hurry up here.
By the way, what's the other category? Is there any suggestion that Hamas is not a terrorist organization? I don't get it.
I guess you could. you could call it a primordial nation, maybe. I don't know. I've never understood that.
Well, okay, but even if you were to call it a primordial nation, which I wouldn't, but even if you were to say it's a government yet to be hatched, I guess that's your implication.
Right, exactly.
That still wouldn't mean it's not a terrorist organization.
You're right. I agree with you. But college campuses seem to think otherwise for some reason, but fair enough.
Well, that may be, but I think a lot of the kids are protesting what they believe is bad behavior on the part of the Israeli government.
I agree. But listen, would you use the word genocide?
That's a tough call. I don't know that we're quite there yet. That is a matter of semantics. I don't like having arguments based on semantics. I also don't like arguments that suggest that you and I should be held accountable for someone else's bad decisions. You know, would I be handling this differently? Absolutely.
Right. I think we all agree on that part. This is not the optimal way of solving issues.
Right.
We get it.
You know, yeah. I hesitate to throw around the word genocide because there are genocidal acts that are an order of magnitude greater that I don't want to diminish, you know, and some of the youngsters, I think, don't completely appreciate some of the tremendous genocides that we've had, not just in distant history, but in recent history.
Sure.
And I would hate to be disrespectful of the magnitude of those situations.
Fair
Having
enough.
Said that, have, you know, in my view, has the Israeli government been insufficiently careful with human life? Yes.
Okay. Okay, fair enough. Stephen Duff says, Chase's platform appears to support the restorative theory of punishment. Given the libertarian position is that the only just theory of punishment is retribution, will the platform be updated?
That's slicing it a little bit thin. As a matter of public policy, we believe that individuals should be held accountable. I think that we all agree on that.
Right.
I do believe that there is a difference between an attitude of case by case and an attitude of blanket policy. And personally, having been involved in the criminal justice system, I think that our government is much too heavy-handed in its inability to handle case by case. And so in that sense, I've got a problem with heavy-handed punishment that suggests that individuals are irredeemable. I'm a bit, for example, this is, again, I'm going to prattle on here for a minute and go in a slightly different direction. But as an example, I believe that it is inappropriate to take away individuals' voting rights. This may not be the biggest issue in the United States, but I think that it's indicative of an attitude that I frankly resent. This idea that the punishment should last, you know, interminably, or that it should in some sense make you a second-class citizen. Mm. I got a problem with that.
Okay, fair enough. Oh, we just answered Stephen. Moving on a little bit here. Ken Corrado asks, does your campaign feel the Fed should continue to influence the economy? Your thoughts?
The Fed does a crappy job of it. So the answer is no. I believe that the Federal Reserve System should end, and specifically because its discretionary policy its discretion over monetary policy has proven ineffective. In many cases, arguably, in a way that exacerbates the boom-bust cycle, but certainly ineffective in mitigating against the boom-bust cycle. And so in that sense, you know, I believe that we need to get out of that business. And believe me, I'm not trying to suggest that the people that are trying to make this happen are either stupid or evil, right? I happen to know, notwithstanding a lot of arguments over a lot of years, I happen to know people that are earnestly patriotic and highly skilled and intelligent who continue to cling to the idea that the Fed can do a good job of controlling the economy. I just happen to know they're wrong.
Mm. And Scotty Bowman piles in, just to prove that, put two libertarians in a room, you get three libertarian positions out of them. restorative justice is a libertarian position. So
it is a libertarian position, and I'm very proud, by the way, of one of my daughters who works in this restorative justice area. I couldn't be any more proud.
Absolutely. Robert wants to know, what does the path away from the Fed look like, Mike?
It's complicated and it's important. By the way, I want to mention the reason Dr. Paul used to talk about this so much, and by the way, still does. He was at the convention.
Yes, he was.
Leading the End the Fed chant. How's that?
That was impressive.
The reason he talks about it so much and always has is not because this is easy, but because it's important, right?
Right.
Ending the Fed is a multi-step process, and it doesn't happen overnight, but it does begin with an announced, publicly committed path. You have to let people know where you're going. Where right. we want to end up is getting rid of it. That's number one. Number two, you need to replace its leadership with people who are dedicated to a rules-based system instead of discretion. You take the discretion away, that allows you to take away monetary policy altogether. And once you've done that, taking away their regulatory authority over banks is an easy hop, skip, and a jump, and that's where all their power comes from. Then you can move legislation against them.
So for you, it really is a roadmap that sounds almost deceptively simple, Mike. Not simple in execution, but deceptively simple in how do we get from A to Z?
Well, you know, it's one of those things that's simple to describe. It's just quite a lift. You know, I could tell you how you lift 500 pounds over your head, too. That doesn't mean that everyone's going to be able to do it.
Right.
And it takes unless you're a beast, it takes a team. And it might take some time. But to be fair, I do know how. But that also means I know that it's not easy and it takes some time. But the first step is a absolute public commitment to it.
I agree. And just a reminder, if anybody wants to either donate or learn more about the Chase Oliver Mike Tremont ticket, go to votechaseoliver.com or lp.org. It's right there on the screen for you. Wanted to remind you that. Let's see if there's any last minute questions. I don't see too many. So, Mike, let's start to wrap up because I know you've been very generous with your time, which is always greatly appreciated. You know, you're a friend of the show. You're a friend of Grumblings Media. I hope you feel the same way about us. It was a pleasure talking to you again, sir. Always someone that I enjoy talking to, even if I don't necessarily agree with everything of your Mises pals there. I do find you and Spike Cohen's another one who, by the way, for our viewers, we're going to have Spike on next week to talk about some of the issues in the Libertarian Party as well. And again, thank you, Mike Tremont. Any last words, Mike, before we go?
Yes. Every time Spike Cohen's name comes up, I get cringy, just amazingly jealous. Mm. He is so popular in our party that it makes me mad. And to know the guy is to know that it's for cause. You know, he's so committed. He understands libertarian philosophy and is committed to it in such a robust way. And he has brought success to our party in a new and innovative fashion that I think a lot of people hadn't even envisioned. And a lot of people weren't even optimistic about You Are the Power when he launched it.
Right.
And it has been successful. Some of the stories are so moving that I would suggest that anyone who can hear our voices right now need to stay tuned to that. I of course, will not watch because I hate Spike Cohen and I'm absolutely jealous of everything he does. But I would encourage everyone to listen because he's extraordinarily successful and a lot of fun.
And listen, we say it about a lot of people. But he is an extraordinary human being as well. When you see him and the work that he and his organization do.
All right, that's enough. Let's not prattle on.
Fantastic. You're absolutely right. But the last question before we say goodbye, Ken Corrado says, how do you get some of the more well-known libertarians in your campaign? For example, Mike, why not ask John Stossel or Kat Timpf to come help you out?
Absolutely. That's an excellent idea. And I will commit Actually, this is no BS. I am committed. I'm writing it down on my piece of paper of my notes here to reach out to John and Kat and see if I can get them involved. It had been on my to-do list to reach out to some notable individuals, but now I'm going to put those at the top of the list, and we're going to see if we can get that done. And if I do, we're going to announce it on Big John.
I'm going to hold you to that promise, Mike. All right. Mike Termont, the vice presidential nominee for the Libertarian Party, along with his running mate for president, Chase Oliver. Thank you, who couldn't make it today, but thank you, Mike, for joining
Chase
us. Really appreciate
it. Chase will come on your show. He wants to come on. He will in the future, and you'll have him for the full-length episode, unpolluted by my presence.
Oh, okay. See, now I'm all excited again. I'm not going to say I wasn't excited for you, Mike, because that would be totally untrue. When next time you blow through New York, we'll visit your old haunts. Maybe we'll hang out down on Wall Street. Maybe go to, what was the George Washington's Tavern where the first, him and his generals, you know which one I'm talking about, right? Right across from,
of course,
right across from the Liberty, from the Statue of Liberty. Oh, the something tavern. I can't remember right now.
I can't remember.
Rats. But you know the one I'm talking about. It's
of course
the one
I do. Everybody does.
Okay, so we're going to have a couple of scotches down there next time you're in New York.
I would love that. Thanks, John. Thanks for your tonight, and thanks for being so great about asking so many really good questions. I have enjoyed it, and I look forward to watching you and Chase in the future.
Mike, truly appreciate it. For everyone out there, you've been watching Free For All right here on Grumblings Media with the great VP candidate, Mike Termont. Join us again next week when our guest will be Spike Cohen. Until then, peace, everyone.